Thanks for being with us today. My in-studio guest this morning is Rich Holmes, a 53-year-old Cape Codder who was diagnosed with a form of muscular dystrophy called facioscapulohumeral, or FSH, which is what we'll be referring to it as today, and he got that diagnosis when he was 39 years old. Welcome, Rich.
Morning, Sean. How you doing?
Good. And did I pronounce that right?
Close.
Okay. Give it a... Let us...
Fascio... scapulohumeral, which refers to some of the areas of the body that are first diagnosed, the face, the scapula or shoulders, and the humerus, upper arm.
I see. And joining us on the phone is Daniel Perez. He's the president and CEO of the FSH Society. He has a background in neurobiology, having also worked on the Human Genome Project. Thanks for joining us this morning, Mr. Perez. Can you hear us, Mr. Perez?
Yes, I can. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for being with us. We had expected to have Dr. Hausman from MIT this morning, but he had some conflict, so I appreciate you stepping in at the last minute, Mr. Perez. And if you have a question or a comment during the show, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or if you're a little shy, you can also email thepoint@wgbh.org. Mr. Perez, I'd like to begin with you. Many of us have heard of muscular dystrophy because of primarily the annual Jerry Lewis Telethon and the work that he's done. I understand that this form of the disease is different and it's actually more prevalent. Could you just tell us a little bit about it?
Well, thank you, Sean. Thank you for having me here and good to be here. Good morning. Facioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy is the most common form of muscular dystrophy in men, women, and children, and it's FSHD is one of the 9 primary types of muscular dystrophy, and muscular dystrophy in general connotes a genetic hereditary muscle disease that causes progressive muscle weakness. And the major symptoms of FSHD is a progressive weakening and loss of skeletal muscles, and the disease is named by the usual location of the weaknesses of the onset of the symptoms, and the origin is the name, essentially face, fascio, shoulder girdle, scapula, and upper arms, humeral. And the early weaknesses can also be seen in the eyes, opening and closing the eyes, mouth, smiling, and puckering, and whistling. And these are the distinctive features of FSHD. It is, all the muscular dystrophies are generally characterized by a progressive skeletal muscle weakness that connotes the biochemical, physical, and structural components of muscle and the death of muscle and cells and tissue.
When do people start to notice the symptoms?
Symptoms, usually there's some indication that there are sex differences in facioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy. We don't know why, but usually for men, it starts in the second decade of life. As they turn, 13, 14, 15, 16, adolescent, after the onset of puberty. And for women, it's usually in the third decade of life, which is in their 20s. And the disease can strike children very severely at the age of 1 month, 5 months, and it can also strike people later years, geriatric, in their 70s and 80s. The typical progression, however, is onset for men between second and third decade, for women between the third and fourth decade.
And it's an inherited disease? Does it primarily from the father, the mother?
The FSHD is known in genetic diseases as a class of diseases known as autosomal dominant diseases. Autosomal dominant connotes that one of your parents, each of us has chromosomes, and we inherit one half from the mother, one half from the father. In FSHD, only one of those chromosomes has the defect, so we only need to inherit the disease from either the mother or the father. And so autosomal dominant means that a parent of either sex, male or female, can pass the disease on to a child of either sex with a 50-50 chance of inheritance. It doesn't mean, so if you have 10 children, it doesn't mean that you'll have 5 children with FSHD. It means that the probability of having children. That would be the average. So some travelers might have none or one child with FSHD, and some travelers might have all 10.
So with this disorder being driven by genetics, what do couples who have, maybe one parent have FSHD, what do they face as they decide whether or not to have children? I mean, are there prenatal genetic testing and other things available for folks?
The FSH Society has helped develop genetic testing across the mid-90s. So until the mid-1990s, we knew very little about the mechanism of FSHD. And FSHD is caused by a deletion of chromosome, just a regular piece of DNA that doesn't currently encode a gene. And so what we're looking for is a deletion of a repetitive stretch of DNA. And so the testing is rather unique in that we're trying to determine, if you could imagine a string, a necklace of pearls that are 100 pearls long, and then in FSHD, people would have 10 pearls left, 10 or less, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. So we're trying to determine how long that repeat or lesion is. And for that reason, the genetic test is a little bit more complicated than standard genetic testing. And to answer your question, the diagnostic testing evolved in the mid-1990s. So just having a diagnostic test without consideration of family planning is a new concept. The prenatal test, given the length of time that it takes to grow the cells, so to answer the question, prenatal testing is available for couples with FSHD. It's usually done through amnio or CVS after conception. And the nature of the test really closes the window down. So, there's always a lot of concern about having all the family members identified so that the family can be tested, mother, father, and expected child, to look for this particular deletion. It is available, and it is fairly accurate. There is also pre-implantation genetic diagnosis through IVF processes, whereby the egg and the sperm are fertilized in embryo, and the embryo can then be tested and then brought to conception. And in that case, though, we don't test for the deletion itself. And there are some risks involved. So for couples who would like to have children with this type of muscular dystrophy, prenatal testing is available as well as PGD IVF.
And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a form of muscular dystrophy called FSH or FSHD. It's the most prevalent form of the disease. And if you have a question or a comment, we welcome you to give us a call. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can also email us at thepoint@wgbh.org. Now, I'd like to go to Rich Holmes in just a second, who has FSH. But first, Mr. Perez, tell us... what type of treatments are available?
What type of what?
Treatments. What type of treatments can patients...
I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Are there different types of treatments available for the disorder?
Oh, I'm sorry. There are no known treatments at this point. So typically we start with physical therapy, physiotherapy, swimming, exercise. We have, FSH Society has been instrumental in trying to get clinical trials moving forward. The consideration here is when you don't know diseases that don't have well-identified biomarkers, such as Alzheimer's or Huntington's, it's very difficult to do clinical trials or run clinical trials and drugs and test them out if you don't have a biomarker to test. And we're setting up a center in Boston, in Watertown, the Boston Biomedical Research Institute and Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. It's called the Senator Paul D. Wellstone NIH Muscular Dystrophy Cooperative Research Center. And its goal is to develop biomarkers for FSHD. And we hope to test various new exciting compounds such as myostatin inhibitors and ghrelins and selective androgen reuptake modulators and different new classes of drugs that can be used to test muscle disease. So right now, things that have been tried are anabolic steroid, prednisone, creatine, myostatin inhibitor by Wyeth Ayrist. There was a trial of a muscle-building compound. Mm-hmm. And here, too, I think the F-State Society and muscular dystrophy has changed in the last 5 to 10 years, where biotechnology and pharmaceutical companies are becoming much, much more interested in compounds that grow muscle and ensure muscle health, not only for disease populations, but for the general non-disease aging, sarcopenia and cancer-related cachexia. So we're seeing a huge emergence of muscular dystrophy drugs and compounds and interest in that. And I think that's thanks to you, Sean, and your listeners for helping us to raise the visibility of muscular dystrophy and the need to try new kinds of drugs.
You're welcome, and thank you for joining us this morning and grounding us in some of the medical and scientific background. I want to move to Rich Holmes, who has FSHD. Rich, tell us a little bit about your story. You spent much of your life unaware that you were carrying the FSHD genes. When did you first begin to recognize some of these symptoms?
Well, I had symptoms probably about age 13, though I did not know it was MD at the time. I had classic winging of the scapula, shoulder blade stuck out. It was junior high. My friends at that age were very clear about pointing that out to me, as kids are. Mm-hmm. I also would do, as a boy, young teen, athletics. I would do them, but I wouldn't, get larger muscles like my friends. We'd lift weights, nothing. I couldn't do as much, and we just wouldn't get that growth and stuff.
What did you attribute that to? You didn't know?
Just being myself, right. I've met other people with FSH too, and a lot of them have a common experience of saying, well, that's just me. Mm-hmm. I remember in college, again, didn't think anything of it at the time because it was so gradual. Whenever I combed my hair, I'd use one arm to support the elbow of the hand that was combing the hair, which no one else did, of course, but I didn't even think about it. It just kind of a compensation that I just developed over time. It wasn't until I was about age 39 that I was diagnosed, and that was after I dropped my right arm. I had dropped a bottle of ketchup, reaching over to pick it up, and a similar experience with a beer stein. And I think, I was in an accident. Car accident 6 months ago. I think I must have pinched a nerve. This one arm, I seemed to be dropping things in a certain position. And after eventually going through a few doctors, I ended up a neurologist, and he diagnosed me.
And so, how about, did you have trouble getting experts, getting someone to diagnose you? I mean, I understand it's the most prevalent form of muscular dystrophy, but I understand from reading the literature and talking to you that even medical professionals don't know a whole lot about it.
That's true. That's very true. Actually, I diagnosed my own brother, who was a doctor, and he wasn't aware of it after I got diagnosed, and I diagnosed my fraternal twin also with it for just seeing the set of their shoulders. And there's some classic physical giveaways, if you do have it and it's progressed to a certain point, that you can cue in on this, the scapula, the way the fold of your skin in your armpit is, it's kind of funny, but it's one of the indicators. There's something called Beaver's sign, which I've done on my children to, whether your belly button moves when you lift your laying down and you lift your head up, it's indicative of the strength of your abdominal muscles in your lower abdomen. Things like that are indicators. It was difficult. I've gone to a neurologist on the Cape because I see one occasionally in Boston. I thought, it'd be nice not to drive that far. And I went to one that was recommended by my physician, and never treated someone with FSH. And so I said thanks, but no thanks, and went back to the teaching hospital.
So you have to travel off Cape in order to get treatments, or
Right. It's not so much treatment because, as Dan said, and mm-hmm. Dan not only is the president of the FSH Society, but he has FSHD himself, and as a scientist. The information that's the scientific information has grown quite a bit, as Dan indicated, in recent years, but the medical literature really hasn't kept up with that, and I think it's still probably considered by most doctors as a fairly rare disease. I remember literature I looked up when I first got diagnosed because I wanted to find out as much as I could, and I think the incidence then was considered 3 in a million cases, births, 3 cases per million births, and now it's 7 in 100,000, I believe, which is, magnitudes of difference. And even that is probably perhaps a conservative estimate because so many people go undiagnosed.
If you're just joining us now, we're talking about a form of muscular dystrophy called FSH or FSHD, and it's the most prevalent form of the disease. And if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. I was just handed a note that Dr. Hausman from MIT is on the phone, and perhaps we could go to him. Dr. Hausman, are you there?
I can't hear you very well, Sean.
We'll try to take care of that.
Close enough. I can hear you now.
Wonderful. So we've talked a little bit about the science behind the disease, and Rich Holmes has told us about some of his personal experience.
Yeah.
So here we have a disease. It's an inherited disorder that is the most common form of muscular dystrophy, and it's also one of the most common diseases of the muscles. But I also understand it receives a fairly small slice of federal dystrophy research dollars. Why is that?
Well, I think that the problem here is that it is not seen as, sort of the sexiest of the muscular dystrophies just yet, even though I personally believe it should be. I think, you've had a history of Duchenne muscular dystrophy being the sort of most, sort of noticeable through the, Labor Day telethon and so on, and it is the case that there's a little bit of public awareness here that needs to be changed, I would think. That's my view anyway.
So is there a competition for research dollars against other forms of the disease?
Well, I think another way to look at this also is that despite the fact that as a group of diseases, the muscular dystrophies have a common element, they actually have different challenges in terms of research. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that there's a competition amongst the different muscular dystrophies, but the ability to focus on the specific issues with, in this case, FSH, is really something that requires, I think, additional effort on the part of the folks down in Washington and additional effort in terms of the community as a whole of scientists.
Dr. David Hausman is a professor at MIT and chairman of the FSH Society Scientific Advisory Board. Let me ask you, Dr. Hausman, what's the prognosis in terms of people's lifespans with this disease?
Well, the prognosis is that people can live quite a good lifespan, which is a positive thing, but the other side of that coin is that people are losing function, in a serious and damaging way throughout their life, almost in many cases from the start of life. I mean, being a kid who can't smile is a real challenge, and correspondingly being an adult who's ability to move and function in terms of their bodily movements, that's a challenge as well. So it's a lot of aspects of FSH that challenge a person throughout life.
I want to ask about that. You mentioned this losing the ability to smile, and that's one of the hallmarks of the disease. People end up often looking sad. And that must be, let me ask Rich this, that must be a very difficult thing to deal with in our society where so much of communication relies on nonverbal cues, such as facial expressions.
Oh, certainly. I mean, maybe I'd be the best person to ask about because I've been fortunate enough not to have lots of facial involvement, at least not yet. I do have some. A little droopiness in my smile, but certainly how you act with someone else and the nonverbal cues you have in the communication, and whether it's someone you know well or not, it's very important, that feedback. Someone's going to know whether you, they think, are you're, whether you're happy with them or not, or, you know, your relationships, you're just greeting people. It's pretty important.
Dr. Hausman, I understand you have a class coming up. One more question.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I'm wondering, knowing what you do about the disease, how does it look in terms of finding a cure?
So I think one has to ask a question like that, thinking about it from, you know, the question of you really don't want to say the cure is about to be found tomorrow. Because when, you know, that's just not a good place to be in terms of way in which folks need to think about it. The cure is through challenges and research that we have to go through. There are certainly, right now, you know, things that are interesting and worth pursuing, which may have a very positive benefit, and those clinical studies need to be begun. To be done, but it's really damaging, I think, to people to be told the cure is going to be next week, and the next week comes, and the cure is not here yet. We have to meet those challenges, and it could be, you know, a relatively short period of time, and particularly I think that will happen if the funds to allow the work to go forward are forthcoming, but it's a challenge, which is, you know, what we do in our world. We take difficult challenges and basically spend our time trying to meet them. So I'm sorry if I can't say it's 3.7 years or 4.9 years. I think that's a damaging kind of thing to, you know, be you know, to put out whenever that clock ticks and the number comes.
If I could jump in, Dr. Hausman, I just wanted to say that because of the complicated genetic nature of the cause of this disease, that it isn't probably one gene, one protein, but maybe several genes affected by the lack of some structure at the end of one chromosome.
Right.
Maybe talking about a cure is somewhat unrealistic. Maybe treatments might be a better approach for the public.
John, the distinction between treatments and cures is one of degree to some extent. If you can... I mean, one of the things that I was said earlier was, you know, this is a problem that has not progressed far from me yet. But the problem that one is concerned with is trying to slow, limit the progression of the issues that a person faces. And if we can, you know, just freeze frame folks at a point in life where we limited the damage, that may be one of the best things that we can do for people.
Dr. David Hausman, a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and chairman of the FSH Society Scientific Advisory Board, thank you for joining us by phone, Dr. Hausman.
My pleasure, Sean. Very nice to speak with you.
You too as well. Rich Holmes in the studio. Let me ask you, how is this disease or disorder affected your work life, your home life, employment?
Sure. Well, with me, it's been gradual. And for as far as employment goes, I've been most fortunate that I'm in the non-physical job of being a journalist. As long as I'm not trying to interview people on the side of a mountain, I'm probably okay. I work at a computer, so... And I'm a manager as well, so that has not been a problem. In my own life, it has been a problem, yes, definitely. I recently moved to single-floor living with an elevator, just, you know, well, number one, some of my became single, so that was changing my household anyways, but that was an overdue move. I was actually putting myself in quite a lot of jeopardy by living in a two-story home where I had to crawl up my stairs to my bed at night. I had to be very careful going down the stairs when carrying something like laundry, which I would try to do to do part, you know, be part of the household, do my bit. But, you know, actually it was quite stupid probably because I could have fallen down the stairs. I've fallen on them several times. I haven't fallen down them. And physically, it limits you in what you can do. I mean, I can't raise my arms above my head and keep them there. So glassware, things in the cabinet, little things. I would never trust myself to hold a baby unless I was sitting down and they were in my arms at that point. I would never do that standing. So when I do have grandchildren, I won't be walking around with them in my arms. I used to enjoy, I was a big biking enthusiast. I hiked and canoed and skied, and I don't do any of those things now. So I've lost a lot of enjoyment. And yeah, and just being able to be with your spouse or your partner, you can't do a lot of things that maybe you'd like to do.
We're coming to the end of our time together, and I want to mention that on Saturday, October 10th, what's being called the first annual Walk and Roll Benefit to support the FSH Society will be held on Cape Cod, and that's going to begin at the Stony Brook Elementary School in Brewster and then along the Cape Cod Rail Trail. I understand, Rich, there's going to be a two-mile course. Folks are welcome to walk it, jog it, rollerblade it, use their wheelchairs, their strollers, whatever they like, and you've been working on this?
Right. Been working on it for almost a year now.
And registration starts at noon on October 10th. And
yes, and you can pre-register by going to www.fshsociety.org, and there's a registration form there. You can donate there too if you can't go to the walk. So, or you can just show up the day of the walk at noon, and we'll be glad to have you.
That sounds like a great event. If you're looking for something to do on Saturday, October 10th, you could certainly help make a difference when it comes to research. I want to thank my guest, Rich Holmes, here in the studio. Thank you, Rich. Daniel Perez, President and CEO of the FSH Society, who joined us by phone, and Dr. David Hausman from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who also joined us by phone. I'm Sean Corcoran. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Jenker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.